I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro, popping in to say we've edited this podcast a little for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
Again and again on the campaign trail, Donald Trump made a promise to carry out mass deportations. Here's how he put it during a campaign rally in New Mexico.
On day one, I will launch the largest deportation program in American history. I will rescue every city and town that has been invaded and conquered, and we will put these vicious and bloodthirsty criminals in jail or kick them the hell out of our country and fast.
The president-elect's border czar, Tom Homan, is actively getting those plans in place.
As far as the deportation operation, we will prioritize public safety threats and national security threats because they're the biggest, they pose the biggest danger to the United States. We're going to take the handcuffs off ICE. ICE knows who they're looking for. Mm-hmm. They just haven't been able to go arrest them because Secretary Mayorkas has told them, you know, to tone down the arrest.
People in our region are preparing too. We're joined today by my colleague Pete Hirschfeld. He recently published a story about how Trump's deportation plan has spurred calls for protections for Vermont farm workers. You can read his story in both English and Spanish on vermontpublic.org. Pete, how are you doing?
I'm good, Michaela.
Thanks for joining us. We also have with us today Jill Martin-Diaz. They're the executive director of the Vermont Asylum Assistance Project and an immigration attorney. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Michaela. It's great to be back.
We're glad to have both of you with us today. And listeners, we are glad to have you too. So, Pete, President-elect Donald Trump has made immigration the center of his campaign in many ways, basically to deport everyone who doesn't have legal authorization to be here. What do you think? Was that rhetoric used only to energize his base during the campaign, or is this something that's really going to happen?
Well, I mean, in a lot of ways, he's sort of doubled down since Election Day, right? He confirmed this week that he plans to declare a national emergency on this issue, deploy military assets to aid in immigration enforcement. He's announced the appointments of immigration hardliners to some key cabinet positions. I mean, look at South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem as his pick of the Department of Homeland Security. But there are plenty of experts who question the efficacy of using the military for this purpose. It's not terribly well designed to accommodate the logistics of the sort of deportation operation that Donald Trump has envisioned. There are also plenty of lawyers who will be ready to argue that that's just not legal. There's a federal law in the book, for example, that prohibits the military from being used for civil law enforcement purposes without approval from Congress. And it's also a question of what does Donald Trump really mean here? I mean, you heard in that bite, he talked about bloodthirsty criminals, right? We heard in the Homan bite that he's talking about criminals who are in this country. I've been to dairy farms in Lamoille County, Franklin County, Washington County, met with farm workers that live here, that work here. I can assure you they're not bloodthirsty criminals. These are people that are grinding day in and day out to feed their families. They are almost to a person law-abiding people in this country. So we're going to find out in the coming months, right, what this all looks like. But there are reasons to be skeptical about whether or not Donald Trump could do what he says he's going to do, even if he wants to.
And Pete, you said almost to a person, the folks we're talking about here are law-abiding. Now, that's not just rhetoric. I mean, it's a small enough population here in Vermont that you kind of can almost know everybody. Do we know about how many undocumented immigrants live in our region, or is it kind of impossible to say because of the nature of their status?
Yeah, you know, I don't have numbers big picture, but Migrant Justice keeps some pretty solid numbers about the number of immigrants who live and work on Vermont's dairy farms, and they peg that number at about 1,500. Those aren't all workers, though. These are people who have been in Vermont, in some cases, for more than a decade. They've made lives here. They have families, right? They have children who are native Vermonters, born here, spent their entire lives here, go to school here. So I can't tell you how many Vermonters are living in this state without legal authorization. But we do know, according to Migrant Justice, that there are about 1,500 immigrants living and working on dairy farms.
And Jill, would love your thoughts here. What have you been hearing from community members and the folks that you work with about what a Trump administration could mean on the ground here in Vermont in terms of immigration policy?
Well, first of all, I want to acknowledge for your listeners how incredibly activating this conversation can be, especially if you're directly impacted. And to use Senator Ram Hinsdale's analogy, like if you do have the capacity to help someone else put on their mask to make it through the challenges of the Trump administration with regards to immigration, we really encourage you to stay with us and keep listening, and please do so. As you can imagine, this is straight out of the first Trump presidency's playbook, right? Almost immediately upon election in 2016, the Trump administration began a series of announcements and campaign promises and setting out policy agendas that gave rise to widespread fear. A lot of people trying to help themselves and help each other on social media, and as a result, spreading a lot of unintentionally misinformational content. Predatory practitioners who are holding themselves out as immigration advocates, charging people money to do nothing to their immigration cases or to put them in a worse immigration position than they're in right now. So, fear is the strategy, and it is having its intended effect, right? Right now, folks, our phones are ringing off the hook, and I know the same is true of our partner organizations in Vermont. Folks with lots of questions, frequently asked questions, and not just from the undocumented, farm worker population, right? The fear-mongering campaign is affecting people who have status, people who have asylum, people who are green card holders or citizens, even people who are naturalized citizens and, or maybe people in mixed status families are afraid right now of being prosecuted for removal. And as a result, we're already seeing a really chilling effect on people's comfortability moving through their daily lives in Vermont, taking their kids to school, going to the doctor when they need it, mm-hmm. asking for help when they need it, mm-hmm. even government-funded service providers are concerned about providing their services because they're worried they're going to be compelled to share client data with the Department of Homeland Security.
Let's bring in a couple voices from our audience. We got an email from Kathy, who writes, "Please do not overlook that there are hundreds of migrant workers involved in many of our state's industries, including construction, roofing, restaurants, landscaping, janitorial jobs, lumber production, refuse and recycling reclamation, grocery store employees, and many other occupations. This community of people is truly the basic infrastructure that holds Vermont together and keeps us operating as we do today." Let's go to the phones now. We have Bob in St. Albans calling in. Bob, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, I agree with that last text. I'm for people, the immigrants that are working, maybe can prove that they've been working for like a year, and that the government comes up with some kind of a process where it helps them to get naturalized and become a citizen, and maybe help make it in a way where it's quicker than later, And my son works for ICE, and I'm sure they can find the bad guys. So if they want to get rid of the bad guys first, I think I'm for that too. We all came into this country, our forefathers, as an immigrant, and we weren't greeted with open arms either. But I think our government should help the people that have already proven that they're here to work. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob, for telling us about that and for bringing up that your son works for ICE. And that brings me to my next question for our reporter, Pete Hirschfeld, which is about how Vermont people in Vermont officials coordinate or don't with ICE and federal authorities around deportation. Now, Pete, all Vermont police departments, I believe, are required to have what's called a fair and impartial policing policy. And there's also a statewide policy. Let's start with that. What does Vermont's look like? What does it do?
So what it does as it relates to this conversation is it tries to prevent state and local police from becoming de facto arms of federal immigration enforcement apparatuses. And so what the fair and impartial policing does policy does is it says state, local cops, when it comes to civil immigration enforcement matters, we are going to prohibit you from sharing certain kinds of information about a person that you encounter that you suspect of being in the country illegally with ICE or with U.S. Customs and Border Protection. So there are prohibitions around, for instance, giving the physical location of somebody. There are prohibitions around giving their address, their physical appearance, the make, model, year of their vehicle, their license plate number. And these prohibitions are designed to ensure that we don't have state and local police playing an active role in immigration enforcement efforts. And the reason that people think that's so important is because regardless of how you feel about what Trump is saying about mass deportation, there's general agreement on the fact that nothing of that scale could take place feasibly without an unprecedented level of involvement from state and local law enforcement agencies. So Vermont officials have come to consensus that they don't want our police playing a role in that effort. And so this fair and impartial policing policy is a tool that they've adopted to try to prevent that from happening.
And meanwhile, we're hearing Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, say he wants governors who say they're going to stand in the way to, quote, I'm quoting here, get the hell out of the way. We're going to do the job with or without you. Jill Martin-Diaz, what are you hearing from folks on the ground about this policy, about fair and impartial policing? Are there concerns that, you know, they could, you know, get pulled over by police or go to the hospital for something and get caught up in the deportation system?
Absolutely. Building on Pete's point about what motivates these non-cooperation policies, from a public health perspective and a community safety perspective, it is absolutely against the public interest for community members to feel like it is unsafe to access social services or call for help or protection when they need it. Right? Vermont passes laws to protect people from abuse, to create emergency responses and interventions when needed, to give them access to emergency health care. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this deliberate fear-mongering tactic on the part of the Trump administration has the effect of making people afraid to engage with their community and engage with the services they need. And the surest way to undermine, you know, efforts by the state to communicate to communities it is still safe to participate in Vermont life is to have, you know, Vermont state law enforcement or local law enforcement carrying out enforcement of federal immigration law that is absolutely outside of the purview of the state of Vermont. And so I do hope that, you know, I'm very grateful to the community organizers who have been advancing the fair and impartial policing policies. What we know from the first Trump administration, peer-reviewed data showed, is that more people are likely to not call for help, to not seek protections, to hide in the shadows without support from social services and from their communities when they think that contact with government yields information sharing with ICE.
Today on the show, we are discussing President-elect Donald Trump's deportation plans and how they could affect Vermonters. Our guests are Vermont Public Reporter Pete Hirschfeld and Jill Martin-Diaz, the executive director of the Vermont Asylum Assistance Project and an immigration attorney. Now, before the break, we were discussing fair and impartial policing practices in Vermont. And there are some towns like Richmond that want to go a step further than the statewide policy. We're joined now by David Sander, who's the chair of Richmond's Select Board. David, thanks so much for calling in.
Hi, Michaela. Thank you for inviting me on.
Tell us a little bit about what you are working on there in Richmond.
Well, Richmond has a small police department, community run, and this whole situation really puts us in a position that we do not want to be in. We model our police department as one that safeguards all residents of the community. What do I mean by that? We encourage our officers to, literally walk the beat, get to know the community, get to know the neighborhood, get to know the business owners, and interact well with the public. And that creates a public trust. So when people unfortunately need to reach out to law enforcement, whether it be they're a victim of a crime or you know, whatever public safety issue comes up, we strongly believe that the community needs to feel safe engaging with law enforcement, and that should be a two-way productive relationship. And the removing of the protections in the fair and impartial policing policy regarding citizenship status really puts members of the community at a very strong disadvantage, where there is a fear to reach out. You know, as Jill was saying earlier, when people reach out to law enforcement, they're often in a very vulnerable position. They've often been exploited, abused, taken advantage of. And for somebody to be in that position and not feel comfortable reaching out, not being able to engage with law enforcement, not getting the protection that they deserve as a member of society, is very upsetting. And it puts the town of Richmond in a unique and uncomfortable position, because the fair and impartial policing policy is adopted by the police chief, not by the select board or the town manager. As the select board, we can advise the department what we would like to see, but that ultimate authority lies with the police chief, and then that policy needs to be approved by the Vermont Criminal Justice Center. And wording of not sharing immigration status is not allowed to be in that policy. So if we submitted one that had that wording in it, it would not be adopted, and then Richmond's fair and impartial policing policy would default back to the state model. So it's a very uncomfortable situation to be in.
Yeah, but Pete, in your reporting, you talked to David Sander and focused a bit on Richmond. Is this happening in other communities across the state that you've heard about?
You know, to my knowledge, based on conversations with the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council, Richmond is the only jurisdiction to date that has submitted a policy that sought to eliminate this prohibition against, that sought to prohibit local police from sharing information about a person's immigration and citizenship status. To be clear, the reason that the council says towns like Richmond cannot tell their local police not to communicate with the feds about a person's immigration status or citizenship status is because there's a federal law that explicitly says, hey, states, you can't tell your local cops that they can't communicate with federal authorities about this specific kind of information. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people, I'm sure Jill can speak better to this than I can, that think that this federal law is unconstitutional. During Trump's first term in office, we were headed toward a likely Supreme Court case in which we would have gotten clarity around this question. But as of now, it's still unresolved.
Hmm. Yeah, let's put a pin in that for one second, because David, I have one more question for you before we let you go. What is the tenor of conversation around this fair and impartial policing policy in Richmond specifically been like? Do you feel like there's consensus, or has it been pretty heated?
There has been consensus, and I'm very proud to live in Richmond. It's a community that I'm very proud to call home. I was kind of struck, but also proud, when this issue came up during the first Trump administration in 2001. There was a very vocal, very large group of people that wanted this protection in our fair and impartial policing policy. I've been on the select board since 2014, when I was first elected. And during the pandemic, when we went to virtual, of course, we started using Zoom. And the one meeting where this came up was the only meeting that Zoom couldn't handle, because our Zoom policy at the time had a limit of 300 attendees, and more than 300 people attempted to call into that meeting to express their views. And understandably so, people are upset that they couldn't get in, and we weren't even aware that we were limited to 300. We changed our Zoom package after that. But yeah, there was a very, very vocal group, a very large vocal group that really wanted these protections in place for all citizens of Richmond, regardless of citizenship status.
Yeah. David Sander, the chair of the Richmond Select Board, thanks so much for calling in. I want to get to another caller who's been waiting patiently on the line for a while now, Mark in Burlington. Mark, what's your question or comment?
Hi. Well, I want to mention I am Hispanic. I do occasionally speak Spanish. I have gotten negative feedback speaking my father's language, even though I don't need to justify where I'm from. I just happen to be born from Los Angeles. But one thing I want to point out, I understand we are sort of in a triage situation. Basically, our Constitution, our democracy, many of our citizens are completely in danger. But mind you, parts that elected Trump were there beforehand. We should realize this. And that I think many of us who have been very aware around racism, reactions toward immigrants, those who appear to be other by people within our state, this has been building up for decades. And I will fault the system, including the governor, that there was not enough out there. Now, the last communication when this issue was brought to Governor Scott, and he mentioned, well, I don't foresee this being feasibly possible. It's not the point whether or not thousands of Vermonters are going to be removed out of suspicion or fear. It's that this is an attempt that the president-elect has said. The first thing has to happen is the emergency legislature called in with the governor and the new legislature how to protect all of us. Because we're talking, and this is, you know,
Mark, I'm so sorry. I'm going to jump in here because I'd really like to get Jill Martin Diaz's thoughts on what you're saying about this difference, as I think you're pointing out, between an actual policy change that could affect Vermonters and just the overall impact of rhetoric and the way that we talk about immigration and undocumented immigrants. And Jill, do you have thoughts to add there to Mark's point?
So many thoughts. Thank you, Mark, for your contributions. I'll begin by saying, as an immigration lawyer who was very fortunate to study the law and teach the law as part of a law school faculty, it really clarified for me, what was motivating the creation of immigration law. And our partners at Migrant Justice said it best, I think, in Pete's article, talking about, the U.S. immigration law was founded in part to exclude and exploit working people and create this quote unquote underclass of folks for whom the immigration law would never offer them pathways to status. And as a result, ensure their structural inclusion forever. And there's always been this zero-sum thinking about how many resources are available and which immigrant populations are quote unquote most deserving. I've been doing some research and writing on VAP's blog about this question of, well, who are the different immigrant subpopulations in Vermont, trying to build a more comprehensive picture of who stands to be impacted by the Trump administration. And it's interesting because I think the reality in Vermont couldn't be more opposite. I've been collaborating with partners in economic development and social service delivery, and all of this expertise. There's all this data that shows that because of Vermont's shrinking population and workforce, not only does our immigrant population already form kind of the backbone of the economy, but without more in-migration and regularized pathways to work and to status, that Vermont's economy and social future is in peril. Like, immigration is essential for the success of Vermont. And so it couldn't be less true about this idea of a zero-sum game. We have to, I would really push back on this idea of whether or not we should concede. I don't believe in ICE enforcement at all. But I think that, what we should be thinking about, rather than which populations are deserving of care and attention and protection, we should be thinking big picture about what kind of Vermont do we want to be? What does a thriving Vermont look like? And what role does supporting all of our immigrant communities, regardless of manner or method of entry, what does that look like? Mm-hmm. And, to the point about local law making opportunities, Vermont's been a leader in the states of what we call new immigration federalism, right? Creating local laws and policies to improve the lived experience of foreign-born people, regardless of status. And I really hope that our lawmakers and leaders continue to do that. Yes, you know, this question that Pete raised around, you know, would certain state laws or policies survive challenges in federal courts? That is an open question. There are lots of open questions. I think that the Trump administration in the first iteration was really robust in testing the limits of the law. And I don't think now is the time for us to back down. We should also continue to test the limits of the law and try what we can within the legal system to protect our community members.
We have just a couple minutes left here, and I want to make sure we address the border that Vermont does have with Canada, where illegal crossings in the Swanton sector in particular have gone up, according to Border Patrol officials. This is something, Pete, that you talk about in your article, your news story. What do we know about the folks who are crossing that border illegally? Do we know, is there a way to know if they're staying here in Vermont?
Oh, gosh. You know, the only piece of information that I have on the northern crossings comes from federal data that I believe shows, and Jill, I'm just going to throw it to you, I think, but there are a lot of Indian nationals that are coming across the northern border. I don't know to what extent they're making lives in Vermont after they do that, but Jill,
yeah,
what do
Jill,
you have to
do
say
you
on
know?
That?
Yeah, so from the CBP reported data that I have looked at, what I'm not clear about is how many border apprehensions or encounters are actually reflective of people who ended up physically crossing from Canada into the US. From what the law says, those numbers could reflect encounters that happen by virtue of our border location with longtime community members, right? Those like all of the different populations, including the ones that Pete reported on. Even folks who've been here a long time, they could be put into expedited removal proceedings, given our location and a number of other factors, and reported as an apprehension or a border crosser. So I think that, you know, the number sounds inflated to me, and it doesn't bear out with the calls for help that we're seeing. I would be curious to know, to dig into the data a little more and parse it out. I think the biggest takeaway from my perspective is we know empirically that closing pathways to regular asylum seeking, people find a way to pursue safety. And when you foreclose safe pathways to invoke your fear of return and to begin an asylum proceeding, it just forces people into more and more dangerous alternative pathways. And so, even if, let's say there was a lot of people who were coming to seek asylum in the Swanton sector.
I have about 20 seconds left.
Yeah, from a harm reduction point of view, the question really shouldn't be like who or how many, but how can we show up to make sure that the government is held accountable for the obligations and due process it owes those people?
Mm. Well, we thank both of our guests for joining us today, reporter Pete Hirschfeld and Jill Martin Diaz with the Vermont Asylum Assistance Project. I want to end here with an email. We just got it from a listener named Fran in Weybridge, who writes, "My grandson, age 18, is a college student in New York City. He was born in Guatemala and adopted as an infant. He's a naturalized U.S. citizen who grew up in Vermont and is now afraid he might be targeted and swept up in a deportation raid. We received many other emails from you with questions about this policy, thoughts on how to support other people in the community, and concerns about America's border issues as well. So we'll continue to have these conversations right here on Vermont Public."